Hello, fan podcast listeners. This is Ryan Van Wyk back with another podcast episode. We are up to 58. Who knew that this could go that far? We do got a couple of news stories to talk about. One of the biggest drug dealers in the world has died today. George Young. He was 78 years old, and his storyline was the basis for the movie Blow. Awesome movie with Johnny Depp. He had started off being a marijuana dealer in the town of Boston, and he was known as Boston George. And what got him busted was that he was transporting 660 pounds of marijuana, and he got busted for that, and he went to jail. Then he got out, and then he branched off into selling cocaine and was one of the biggest suppliers of cocaine. And one of his biggest, partners in the cocaine business was another cocaine supplier, Pablo Escobar. And they forged a partnership and stuff like that. And then eventually it went downhill. And then the movie Blow talks about his rise and fall in the cocaine business. And that was that. And, but they didn't give a cause of death on him, but they just said he was 78 years old. So I'm going to guess he was just old. Another thing is, I didn't get a chance to watch, and since I haven't been able to watch any of the baseball games, except for what little clips I find on the internet, the Cubs were able to take the doubleheader series yesterday against the Dodgers. The Cubs won the first game 7-1, and then they won the second game 4-3. So back-to-back wins is good for that part. They needed it. Yep. And my arm is healing after I got my COVID shot last week. My arm had hurt for 3 days, but now it hasn't been hurting since Monday. So it was 4 days. I got my shot Thursday, and then my arm hurt up until Monday, and then it stopped hurting. But eventually, it might hurt again when I get the second shot back, which is May 27th of this month. I'll get the second one again. And I did have a headache for a couple days or two for that. This is a good read right here. This morning, an oversight board created by Facebook approved the company's January decision to indefinitely suspend Donald Trump from its platform and gave the company 6 months to clarify the duration of the suspension. The result is a bit of a procedural dodge, but there was only one reasonable path available for the company to take: ban the former squatter permanently. The reasons for this are straightforward, and in many ways, the questions of sanction for Trump is no different from the theory of how a society sanctions any sort of misbehavior. Understanding how a punishment is generally chosen can help answer the question of what the result of what the right result might be for Trump. The first concept to consider is that of a general deterrence. The question here is how to set the sanction at a level that will persuade others not to commit similar acts. Given that not all bad actors are caught, the theory of deterrence is that the penalty imposed must be significant enough to deter the others. And to put it simply, how will the sanctions on Trump impact other political leaders on Facebook? Will it embolden Trump permitting that Trump will return? Hopefully not. And it would tell future leaders that serial falsity is a relatively costless, and to send the right message, the ban must be permanent. But next comes the question of specific deterrence or disablement. And it's distinct from general deterrence, and this asks whether the speaker needs to be effectively disabled from engaging in a prohibited act in the future. A serial robber cannot rob while he's in prison, so here we look at Trump and his nature and ask whether he's likely to be a repeat offender. More than likely he will be, and the answer seems fucking clear. If Facebook restores Trump to the platform, He will continue lying again, as he always does, and when he does, Facebook will again will have to banish him from the platform, at least for long enough to prevent him from damaging the next election. If Trump is reinstated, I recommend saving this article, and it will be relevant again in a year or so. And finally, there is the factor of contrition. And to what extent has the actor acknowledged the nature of his prior acts and demonstrated remorse or behavioral adjustment? The greater the contrition, the less severe the sanction. And by contrast, in the absence of a clear recognition of culpability and harm, it is reasonable to believe that the actor will repeat the activity even at a risk of additional harm. And this renders severe sanctions more compelling. Can anyone, looking at these factors, seriously doubt what the result should be? Just consider the harm Trump has done with his megaphone 4 months ago when violent mob stormed the United States Capitol in an attempt to overturn the presidential election. That insurrection was incited by a lie, and the lie was that the election had been stolen and that Trump was the true winner, which he really wasn't. And far from fading away, that lie has metastasized and has become an article of faith among some voters. It has also become a litmus test of loyalty, so much so that one cannot, it seems, continue to hold a position of leadership in the Republican Party unless one is willing to shove the riot down a memory hole and publicly embrace as truth that which is manifestly false. The election lie was spread by many, but the lead proponent was Trump himself. He used Facebook and other social media to propagate the falsehood and postings that led to violence and death at the heart of American democracy. At no point has Trump demonstrated contrition, and every signal has indicated that he remains undeterred. Indeed, one can make the argument that Facebook acted too late and with insufficient force by not banning Trump earlier. But Facebook enabled and encouraged more and more brazen posts by Trump and other high-profile speakers precisely because at that time there was no sanction. But given that, does one realistically think that if he is allowed back on this Facebook platform, Trump will not return to his fraudulent ways? If any evidence was needed, on Monday, Trump made clear that he has no plans to refrain continuing to spread his lies. In response to claims that he was lying about the election, he issued a statement declaring that, to the contrary, that the 2020 election itself will be from this day forth known as the big lie. And were this persistent dishonesty just the repetition of a casual lie of no importance, it could be of no practical moment. One can, for example, persist in a counterfactual belief that the earth is flat and this creates no societal harm, but Trump's lies are more than that. They're an imminent and persistent danger to democracy itself. But years ago, considering a question of free speech, Justice Robert Jackson gave voice to a cautionary idea. The choice is not between order and liberty. It is between liberty with order and anarchy without either. There is danger that if the court does not temper its doctrinaire logic with little practical wisdom, it will convert the Constitutional Bill of Rights into a suicide pact. He was speaking about government regulation of speech and the dangers that came from the lack of limits, but what he said then is equally true today of commercials, social media platform and their moderation of the content that they host. The platforms are themselves the product of a robust liberal democracy in which order and liberty contend daily. The social media platforms cannot allow themselves to become the germinating soil for the seeds of their very own destruction and that of the society that enabled them. And by dodging a final decision and throwing the burden back on Facebook, the oversight board merely postponed the inevitable reckoning. Yeah, I agree with banning Trump forever. Today they were supposed to decide whether Trump was supposed to be back on Facebook or not. But it says today we found out that the former squatter Donald Trump will not gain any access back to his Facebook or Instagram accounts for now. In case you forgot this, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube all suspended Trump after his sycophants attacked the Capitol on January 6th. It's my bitney with your guide to social media's beef with Trump. Facebook's oversight board upheld the social network suspension of Trump, but urged the company to review his case in 6 months' time, which could clear the way for a possible return to the platform, hopefully not. Facebook can decide to impose a suspension permanently, ban him, or appeal again to the board. Members of the oversight board said they recommended that Facebook institute clear and proportionate policies that promote public safety and respect freedom of expression. In the ruling, the Facebook oversight board said that Trump's comments on the day of the Capitol siege created an environment where a serious risk of violence was possible. And how does Trump move forward with this? Because it would be hard for him to raise any money anyway. Facebook's decision to maintain its ban on Trump again deprives the ex-squatter of a long-range megaphone and an effective fundraising machine, elements that would be central to Trump-backed campaigns in the 2022 congressional races and perhaps the 2024 squatter will race again. In the meantime, Trump will have to stick to written statements and media appearances to raise money and spread his lies. And it's more bad news for Trump anyway, because a federal judge blasted the Trump Justice Department for misleading the court about the nature of its internal deliberations before concluding that the then squatter Trump had not obstructed the former special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, which he did everything he could to obstruct that. The U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson had ordered the release of a 2019 legal memorandum to a government accountability group, ruling the document prepared for the then Attorney General William Barr, fat ass, as he prepared to issue his conclusions, did not qualify as a protected attorney-client communications. Let's take a real quick look on the SCOTUS part. A majority of the Supreme Court had voiced skepticism Tuesday over allowing a certain low-level drug offenders to seek reduced sentences under bipartisan criminal justice legislations that was signed into law by Trump in 2018. The appeal had stirred a debate at the nation's highest court about Congress's intent when the First Step Act had permitted some offenders to seek shorter sentences but not others. The landmark law was intended to ease tough-on-crime policies that swelled the prison populations and had a disproportionate impact in African-American communities. There's a truth about Trump's Operation Warp Speed. The millions of people across the United States have already received doses of vaccines against coronavirus, and vaccines developed as part of Operation Warp Speed. The project conceived, initiated, resourced, and largely executed under Trump administration leadership. Daily, millions more joined their ranks, but listening to members of the liberal media and the Biden administration, one could be forgiven for not clearly understanding the pivotal role leaders within the Trump administration, along with the private sector partners, played in developing manufacturing and delivering over 300 million safe and effective vaccines in less than 1 year to the American people. After President Biden's address to the nation last week, Nicole Wallace of MSNBC commented that the OWS didn't do anything to get a needle into the arm of any American. But in February, Vice President Kamala Harris commented that the Biden administration was in many ways starting from scratch, and Jeb Zients from the administration's COVID-19 task force commented recently that the Trump administration had no plan to vaccinate Americans. Of course it didn't. The Biden administration overall COVID-19 response performance in its first 100 days, averaging over 75,000 cases per day and over 1,700 fatalities per day, has been less effective than the year during which the Trump administration was overseeing that response, 60,000 cases and 1,100 deaths per day, respectively. On January 20th of 2021, there were approximately 24.5 million total COVID cases and 405,000 fatalities in the U.S., and this was 1 year into the pandemic, and in the first 100 days of the Biden administration, we added 7.8 million cases, 32.3 million total, and 170,000 fatalities, which is 575,000 total. So much for extinguishing the virus. Also, as of May 1st, close to 70 million of the 310 million vaccine doses distributed are sitting idle in the U.S. vaccination sites. And we were criticized for having less than one-tenth this number of vaccines sitting idle. And these are inconvenient facts, and so one will not likely hear them from MSNBC or CNN or foe. And clearly, President Biden is learning that governing is more difficult than campaigning. But many in the media attribute the success of OWS to some sort of miracle. A deus ex machina introduced to unravel the mysteries of vaccine development and manufacturing. And in fact, the success of OWS, which stands for Operation Warp Speed, was a function of exceptional leadership, a deliberate strategy, and an exacting execution. But OWS was conceived in the spring of 2020 by the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, who's a former pharmaceutical company executive who deeply understood the motivations, the risk tolerance, and complexities of drug development, manufacturing, and distribution. It was immediately embraced by the former squatter Trump, who ensured that we had the financial resources, attention, talent, and government support required for the success. But shortly thereafter, we added a number of other exceptional leaders, Dr. Moncef Soloi, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, the most accomplished vaccine developer of our generation, Generals Perna, Ostrowski, and Shrevston from the Army Logistics Command, and Carlo de Notarius Stefani, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right either, a distinguished pharmaceutical manufacturing expert, Dr. Francis Collins at the National Institutes of Health, who oversaw the clinical trials, and the dumbass Jared Kushner as the White House liaison. And this country owes the vaccines we have to this team of leaders. Actually, we don't. They're not really leaders. But basically, they're full of shit on this one. Oh, shit. Yeah, those are gonna. That's gonna be the one thing that grosses me out. They're supposed to have a big. This year, we're supposed to have one of the worst outbreaks of cicadas coming out to emerge. Coming out of Columbia, Maryland, or basically, I think, yeah. Sifting through a shovel load of dirt in a suburban backyard, Michael Rupp and Paula Shrewsbury find their quarry, a cicada nymph, and then another, and then another, and then four more. And maybe a third of a square foot of dirt, the University of Maryland entomologists find at least seven cicadas, which is a rate just shy of 1 million per acre, and nearby yard yielded a rate closer to 1.5 million. And then there's much more afoot. Trillions of the red-eyed black bugs are coming, scientists say. And within days, a couple of weeks at most, the cicadas of the brood X. The X is the Roman numeral for 10. And it will emerge after 17 years underground, and there are many broods of periodic cicadas that appear on the rigid schedules in different years, but this is one of the largest and most notable, and they'll be in 15 states, including Indiana to Georgia, and then to New York, and they're coming out now in mass numbers in Tennessee and North Carolina, and when the entire brood emerges, backyards can look like undulating waves, and the bug chorus is lawnmower loud. Yeah, I knew about that one. The cicadas will most likely come out at dusk to try to avoid everything that wants to eat them. Squiggling out of holes in the ground, they'll try to climb up trees or anything vertical, including the people, the Rupp and Shrewsbury. But once off the ground, they shed their skins and try to survive that vulnerable stage before they become dinner to a host of critters, which include ants, birds, dogs, cats, and Rupp. It's one of nature's weirdest events featuring. Sex, a race against death, evolution, and what can sound like a bad science fiction movie soundtrack. But some people are repulsed by cicadas like me. Psychiatrists are calling the entomologists worrying about their patients, Shrewsbury said. But scientists say the arrival of Brood X is a sign that despite pollution, climate change, and dramatic biodiversity loss, something is still right with nature, and it's quite a show. Rupp represents the narrative of a cicada's lifespan with all the verve of a Hollywood blockbuster. You got a creature that spends 17 years in a COVID-like existence, isolated underground, sucking on plant sap, right? In the 17 years, these teenagers are going to come out of the earth by the billions, if not trillions, and they're going to try their best to try to best everything on the planet that wants to eat them during this critical period of the nighttime when they're just trying to grow up and they're just trying to be adults and they're shedding that skin and they get their wings, they go up into the treetops and escape the predators, he said. Once in the treetops, hey, it's all going to be about romance. It's only the males that sing. It's going to be a big boy band up there as the males try to woo the females and try to convince that special someone that she should be the mother of his nymphs. And he's going to perform, sing songs. If she likes it, she's going to click her wings, and they're going to have some wild, sex in the treetop. And then she's going to move out to the small branches, lay the eggs, and then it's going to be all over in a matter of weeks. And they're going to tumble down. They're going to basically fertilize the very plants from which they were spawned. 6 weeks later, the tiny nymphs are going to tumble 80 feet from the treetops, and they're going to bounce twice, and they're going to burrow down into the soil to go back underground for another 17 years. But this, Rob says, is one of the craziest life cycles of any creature on the planet. America is the only place in the world that has periodic cicadas that stay underground for either 13 to 17 years. This is what the entomologist John Cooley of the University of Connecticut says. The bugs only emerge in large numbers when the ground temperature reaches about 64 degrees or higher. And that's happening earlier in the calendar in recent years because of a climate change, says the entomologist Gene Kritsky. Before 1950, they used to emerge at the end of May, and now they're coming out weeks earlier. Though there have been some early bugs in Maryland and Ohio, where soil temperatures have been in the low 60s, so Rupp and other scientists believe the big emergence is days away. Which is to say, about a week or two at max. Cicadas who come out too quickly don't survive, and they're quickly eaten by predators. Cicadas evolved a key survival technique, overwhelming numbers, and there's just too many of them to get all eaten when they all emerge at once, so some will survive and reproduce, Rupp says. And this is not an invasion. The cicadas have been here the entire time, quietly feeding off tree roots underground, not asleep, but just moving slowly, waiting for their body clocks to tell them that it's time to come out and breed. And they've been in America for millions of years, and far longer than people. And when they fucking emerge, it gets really fucking noisy. 105 decibels noisy, like a singles bar gone horribly, horribly wrong, Coley says, but there are three distinct cicada species, and each one has its own unique mating song. They aren't locusts, and the only plants they damage are young trees, which can be netted, but the year after a big batch of cicadas, the trees actually do better because the dead bugs serve as a fertilizer. People tend to be scared of the wrong insects, says University of Illinois entomologist May Barenbaum. Like the mosquito kills more people than any other animals because of the malaria and other diseases. But some people really dread the cicada emergence like me. I think it's the fact that they're an inconvenience, but also when they die in mass numbers, they smell bad, Barenbaum says, but they really disrupt our sense of order. But others are fond of cicada and munch on them, nasty, using recipes like those in the University of Maryland cookbook. And for scientists like Cooley, there is a beauty in their life cycle, not really. This is a feel-good story, folks, not really. It really isn't, and it's in a year we need, and it's in a year where we don't need more, he says. Yeah, I've never really been a big fan of cicadas. To me, they're fucking creepy. I'm going to guess that it's a Trump supporter who did this. Coming out of San Francisco, two elderly Asian women were stabbed without warning as they were waiting for a bus in downtown San Francisco, the latest in a series of attacks against Asian Americans nationwide since the start of the pandemic last year. A woman working at a flower stall Tuesday afternoon told KGOT TV that she saw a man walking on Market Street shortly before the attack carrying a pretty big knife with knuckles on the handle. The lady's back was turned, and the witness said that all she could see was feathers come out of her jacket. So the lady said that I'm sure that she got stabbed. The witness said of one victim, he walked away like nothing happened, like Sunday morning. Police said the 63 and 84-year-old woman remained hospitalized Wednesday, but the 84-year-old was initially treated for life-threatening injuries. But her medical status has been upgraded to non-life-threatening, police said. Patrick Thompson, 54, of San Francisco, was arrested about 2 hours after the attack. Investigators were working to determine whether the incident was motivated by racial bias. The attack highlighted the dangerous climate Asian Americans have faced since the coronavirus entered the U.S. after servicing in China, and racially motivated harassment and assaults have occurred nationwide. and these are horrifying, deliberate attacks on Asian residents that are often elderly, said the San Francisco supervisor Matt Haney, who represents the area where the latest attack occurred. We have to stop this. People need to be able to walk down the street safely and wait for a bus without fear. But elsewhere, a police hate crime task force in New York City was investigating the recent incident in which a 31-year-old Asian woman and her companion walking in the Midtown Manhattan were accosted by a woman with a hammer. But surveillance video released by police shows the attacker saying something to the woman and hitting one with the hammer and swiping at the other before leaving. Police said the woman who was struck suffered a head laceration and later told police that the attacker told her to take off her mask before she was hit, but no arrests had been made. In an incident near Times Square in March, a man was seen kicking and stomping a 65-year-old Filipino woman in front of an apartment building. A parolee who had been convicted of killing his mother 2 decades ago was arrested. Another man was arrested last month on hate crime charges in an attack on an Asian immigrant in East Harlem. The 61-year-old victim was collecting cans when he was attacked from behind and knocked to the ground and kicked in the head. New York is among several cities where police are beefing up on patrols in Chinatown. The San Francisco Bay Area has also seen an increasing number of attacks against the Asian Americans. California prosecutors have filed assault and hate crime charges against a man who was accused last week of yelling racial slurs before knocking down Carl Chan, who was a president of the Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce. In separate attacks in San Francisco and in March, an 83-year-old Vietnamese man was knocked down and broke his neck, and a 77-year-old woman was attacked. Police arrested a man on suspicion of assaulting an elder, abuse in both cases. Another 83-year-old man was pushed down in February and broke a hip, and he spent weeks in a hospital and rehabilitation. Oh, yeah, I remember this one. An avowed anti-Semitist who testified that he wanted to kill Jews and was sentenced to death after he shot and killed 3 people at Jewish sites in the suburban Kansas City in 2014 has died in prison, the Kansas Department of Corrections said Tuesday. Fraser Glenn Miller, 80, had died Monday at the El Dorado Correctional Facility, where he was serving a sentence for capital murder, attempted murder, assault, and firearms conviction. An autopsy will be performed to determine the cause of death for the Republican, but preliminary indications were that Miller died of natural causes. But Carol Pitts, a spokeswoman for the Corrections Department, said in a statement she declined to comment further on Miller's death or any medical condition. The Corrections Department initially said it and the Kansas Bureau of Investigations would investigate Miller's death, which is routine after an inmate dies. But the KBI later said it would not investigate the death because Miller was receiving regular medical care and his death was to be expected because of his age. In March, Miller's attorneys argued before the Kansas Supreme Court that his death sentence should be overturned, in part because they said he should not have been allowed to represent himself in a complex death penalty case anyway. Miller had drove from his home in Aurora, Missouri, and he was determined to kill all the Jews. On April 13th of 2014, he ambushed William Corcoran, 69, and his 14-year-old grandson, Reet Underwood, at the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park, Kansas. He then drove to a nearby village called Shalom Care, the nearby village Shalom Care Center, and killed somebody named Terry Lamano. Two of the victims were Methodist, and the other was Catholic. Relatives of Corcoran and his grandson said in the statement that they were neither happy nor sad when notified of the death. Basically, he stole so much from our family, but he didn't steal our hearts or our dignity, they said in a statement, without naming Miller. He did not steal our memories, but the love that sustains us or the ability to offer forgiveness and kindness in the face of such tragedy. The Corcoran family had created the Faith Always Wins Foundation after the killings in an effort to promote forgiveness, kindness, faith, and healing, rather than hate and retribution. They said that the murderer was rotten to his core, and never asked for the family's forgiveness or expressed any regret. But they said that he was taught by his father to hate, which drove him to murder. And this is heartbreaking. The family said, "We are sad, but we miss our family." Basically, they miss Bill and Reet, but we don't carry the weight of hate in our hearts. Miller, who was also known as Fraser Glenn Gross Jr., had also testified at trial that he wanted to kill all the Jewish people before he died. He said he didn't expect to live long enough because he had chronic emphysema. During his trial and at his sentencing, Miller frequently interrupted the proceedings to give rambling statements about his belief that Jewish people were running the government, media, and the Federal Reserve, which they're not. But during his closing arguments at trial, Miller said he had been floating on a cloud since the killings, and when he was convicted and when he was sentenced to death, Miller had raised his arm in the Nazi salute, which means that basically he was a Republican. Miller was a Vietnam War veteran who founded the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in his native North Carolina, and later the White Patriot Party. Well, technically, you can't be a patriot if you're a Republican. He also ran on the White Power platform during campaigns for the U.S. Senate in 2006 and the U.S. Senate in 2010, but he lost those. In his death sentence appeal in March, Miller's attorneys argued that he was incapable of understanding the legal intricacies of a complicated death penalty case and should not have been allowed to represent himself, even though he insisted on being his own attorney. Attorney Reed Nelson said Miller's standby attorney should have been allowed to intervene during the penalty phase. But Lisa Taylor, a spokesperson for the Kansas Office of Judicial Administration, said that Tuesday that once the court is officially notified of Miller's death, it will determine the appropriate action, and the court could decide that there are questions of law that still must be decided. Oh, man. It looks like we also have sad news in baseball, too. Ray Miller has died. He was a manager for baseball. He only lasted a couple years. He managed the Minnesota Twins from 85 to 86, and then he walked away for 13 years before becoming the manager of Baltimore Orioles for 2 years. So in his two-year career as a manager, he won 266 and lost 297. But he never made it to the majors, but he did pitch in the minors. Calls says he was 76 years old, but no cause of death has yet been given on him. That's really about it there, because I got some other stuff I got to do, so I'm going to have to go. But